Kildare Today with Clem, Owen and Kira.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Thanks to various listeners who told me the Canadian who drank copious pints during his snooker matches was Bill Werbenick. Remember him? Yeah, big man he was indeed. Maria, you obviously know your sport in terms of talking about that. And Mick in Kilcullen also came up with Bill Werbenick. And another listener, Seamus, says, TDs and former TDs parking. Should the recently retired Chief of Staff be let park in Dublin Barracks or indeed the Department of Defence in Newbridge? Or senior retired medical staff across the country be allowed park in hospitals as Mrs. Bone is now in New York? Can anyone pitch for her space at Leinster House, Seamus? Only Ireland would have such a park for retired politicians, while the working plebs now heading back to the offices in the city paid top dollar for the privilege. Another listener sent me a long, long thread in regards to frontline workers. Wouldn't have time to read it all, but just to say that, hello, I write this with absolute fury. I'm a teacher. I've been watching with interest the absolute rubbish that we are seeking a bonus for our participation during the pandemic. We had no idea that the unions were going to seek same. I also watch with fury as I see many other sectors jump on the bandwagon seeking reward. Yes, teachers, shop assistants, lorry drivers, on post staff, farmers, etc., etc., continue to work. We got paid to do so. As a nurse in ED, this message of support and attached photos was much appreciated, and it goes on to say about what really are frontline workers and those that made the real sacrifice, and apparently all those other sectors now jumping in the bandwagon. If they get something, we want something too. The migrant women's networking group Aki Dwa is reiterating its call for a national action plan on female genital mutilation. Let's hear more about that now, because I'm joined by Dr. Caroline Munyi, and I hope I got your name correct, Caroline, migrant women's health coordinator with the organisation Aki Dwa. Good morning, Caroline, and thank you for joining us this morning. First of all, I suppose, to many of us in the Western world, this sounds absolutely barbaric, female genital mutilation. But let's contextualise it first. Associated primarily with Nigeria, I think, maybe in other African countries as well. The thinking and the rationale behind it, Caroline.
Yes, we're looking at female genital mutilation as a harmful cultural practice. This because, in that context of culture, if we look at it, it's harmful because not all cultural practices are harmful. And we feel that that is the best way to approach the practice, and so that the people who are practicing or the affected communities will not feel targeted. And I want to say that it's not associated just with Nigeria. It's practiced in 29 African countries. It is also practiced in the Middle East and Indonesia.
What is the rationale behind this practice of female genital mutilation? Which, by the way, if there's anybody out there who's of a sort of sensitive nature, they might want to be alert now to this particular element of the conversation, and particularly if there are children listening or whatever else in regards to that. I understand, and I'm trying to put this as sensitively as possible, that the female genital mutilation, it involves the cutting of the clitoris order to prevent a woman enjoying sexual fulfillment. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, that could be one of the reasons, and also to make women not be promiscuous. And also in cultures or in communities where it is prevalent, it's also done to make women more marriageable. And it's a way of controlling. It's all about power and control.
Caroline, how would it mean? And I'm sorry about, because this is be fascinating for many people from cultures where, you know, who would recoil from this. How would it make women more marriageable if their clitoris is removed?
Yeah, because we said earlier that even the time of the day that maybe you may having maybe children who are listening to this, so I don't want to go very deep into some of these issues.
I understand.
So, It makes it easier for women to be controlled, and I've said that it also makes women not to be promiscuous, that is to stay virgins until they are married, because it makes even the very nature of intercourse very painful. So a woman will not even dream of sleeping with anybody outside marriage or even before she gets married, because her husband will know, and that would be a shame to her family.
Now, it's a practice that's internationally recognised as a human rights violation of women
exactly.
and girls. It is, of course, at its ultimate, the most abhorrent form of physical and psychological violation of women and girls. And in particular, the circumstances under which this practice is often carried out, I want to be very careful here, but it verges on the word of backstreet butchers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Now, the concern, of course, is that this is a practice, because of the movement of migrants right across the world, it's a practice that has now become prevalent in other countries, including here in Ireland.
Yes.
We're told that the practice is still carried on, women and girls being considered impure, outcasts are unmarriageable unless they undergo a female genital mutilation.
Yes.
5,790 women and girls living in Ireland have suffered this.
Yes, that's the number. Yeah, that's the number of women who are affected. Who are affected by FGM here in Ireland, and who require specialized services to look after their physical health as well as their mental health.
One woman, it's not her real name, Balu, she was about 12 years old when she was subjected to this in Nigeria, where she's from.
She thought
she was going on a holiday to her grandmother's house, but soon realised she had been tricked. We don't need to go into the details of it.
Aside
from the 5,790 women and girls living in Ireland who have suffered this, I mean, people will be appalled that this is going on backstreet rooms around this country. But a further 1,632 girls living in this country are estimated to be at a high risk of this be happening to them.
Yes, that's the number of girls who are at risk. And that's why Akidwa is calling for the government to have a government-led national action plan, so that FGM services can be mainstreamed in hospitals in Ireland, so that a woman can walk into any hospital with an FGM-related problem, and she does not need to be referred to a specialised clinic that should be seen in any hospital, however far away from Dublin. And it's because we are also cognizant of some of the challenges which these women might be encountering, especially those women in the DPs, that they may not be having maybe transport to bring them to Dublin. And also we are looking at the issue of stigma, that it's also a very stigmatizing problem. And because of the women's dignity, it would be better if a woman can just walk into a hospital, she's screened, and then she's directed to a qualified medical doctor who can look at her need in any hospital in Ireland. So that is what Akidwa is agitating for. And we also feel that this will increase the protection of girls who are at risk. Because we are
of
also
course,
concerned about the girls. Yeah.
This is a crime. Under our laws, the maximum penalty for offenders is a fine of up to €10,000 or imprisonment for up to 14 years or both. But I have to say, Caroline, as I'm aware, and I'm sure you're even more aware because your organisation has been advocating about this for over 20 years, that the number of cases that actually brought to court are negligible. We know of one course during the year where we heard about the practice being carried out on a baby.
Yeah,
it's not just, and maybe this is something we should bring across to people. This is not just perpetrated on mature women or even young girls. This is a practice that's sometimes perpetrated on babies.
It was cruel, and that case was successfully prosecuted, and people were behind it are now behind bars.
So how confident can we that what you're aiming here is that, you know, women who are in this situation would be able to access the services of any hospital around the country, that will be fully available to them?
Because we feel that right now what we have in Ireland is not the services for women who are affected by FGM, they are not mainstreamed, that they have to go to a specialized place which is far from where most of the women live, for example. And also we feel that it increases the stigma. Hence, recognizing FGM as a problem in Ireland today would be great. And then we put the government-led national action plan is put in place. And this will also mean that there will be funding for FGM services and also for people who are working in the area of FGM. And also like for Akido, where we work with our community health ambassadors, who are very critical in the communities, that will be some funding to facilitate their work as well.
Okay, the idea that the woman who has been impacted by this has to go to a specialized hospital, which might be hundreds of miles away from her own home. Obviously, the core issue is that the services should be available in our general hospitals right around the country, so that women can access this, because these women are sometimes, and many are very often, on the margins as well. Caroline, it's an horrific situation. I think most people will be shocked to hear that 5,790 women and girls in this country have suffered female genital mutilation, and that there are a further 1,632 girls living in Ireland estimated to be at high risk, and that, you know, access to general services around the country to deal with this is not yet available. Hopefully that will change. Dr. Caroline Monye, Migrant Women's Health Coordinator with the organisation Akidwa, which is marking its 20th anniversary this year, reiterating calls for a national action plan to deal with this appalling practice, irrespective of the rationale, the cultural rationale behind it. Caroline, thank you for your time this morning.
And thank you very much for having me.
You're more than welcome. Thank you indeed.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Today, Kildare County Council launches its integration strategy. Joining me is the Chair of Kildare Integration Network, Sarana Pashik, and Chair of Kildare Interagency Integration Committee, Aoife Breslin. Councillor Aoife Breslin, good morning to both.
Good morning, Ciara. How are you?
Hello,
and
Ciara.
Aoife Breslin is enough, not Councillor.
Okay, it's good to know. Sarana,
good morning,
beginning.
Sarana. How are you?
Hi, Aoife.
Beginning with you, Zorana, obviously the Minister for Children will today be attending the online event. So the aim of the integration strategy is to support the inclusion of people from ethnic minorities and new communities living, working or studying here in County Kildare. Just briefly, I guess, to begin, what are the clear objections of the strategy?
Well, as you said yourself, the probably the most important objection objective of the strategy is to support the inclusion and integration of those of diversity of backgrounds and ethnic minorities. And when we are talking about integration, you know, we are thinking of different levels. So personal, cultural, economic, economical, and political. So throughout all of them, and the huge way of supporting integration, obviously, is attending education. So education is a vehicle for integration as well. So you know, looking at I suppose those vehicles, that would be very important.
And Zoriana, obviously yourself, you've come to Ireland and you've integrated. Did you take from your own experience in terms of launching this strategy?
Of course, yes. You know, I've been just recalling preparing my speech for today's launch, and I have been living in Ireland for the past 15 years. And, you know, integration doesn't come easy for anybody. Coming to the country as an asylum seeker, I think it was even more difficult to feel part of the society, you know. But I suppose the way we look at integration, it's a two-way process. So I want to do my work to be included in the society, but also the society has to support me to feel integrated, you know. So I think having such a supportive structure that we have in County Kildare, you know, the work that County Council is doing, the work that County Kildare Leader Partnership is doing, and also such amazing people that are so welcoming, that all worked out very well, you know. And I hope not only for me, you know, because yes, it's not about me. It's about all of those people out there.
Yes, but it's great, obviously, taking your experience. It's going to help others and to make this strategy something even greater. Aoife Breslin, how are you celebrating today?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful occasion and I'm really looking forward to it. You know, so much hard work has gone into this and so many agencies have come together to draw up the strategy. And look, I mean, Dorianne and Beth from Kin are kind of hiding their shadow under the tree, as I would say, because they were vital to the whole process here. I mean, and they've played such a huge part in it and will play a part in it going forward. I mean, there's been a lot of people involved in it, you know, from TUSLA, the HSE, ourselves, the PPN. Anybody in Kildare has been drawn together to sit on this committee, and we're ensuring that this is a strategy that has aims that will be delivered. We will have a coordinator working on it and daily from Kildare Leader Partnership. So, you know, it's not going to sit on the shelf. It's not going to get dust. It's going to be a working document that we're going to be quarterly on, we're going to review annually, and we're going to input into it. And some of the measures are very easy on it. Some of the measures are not so easy. I mean, I know Clem gave us time before Ciara to talk about it when we were going through the consultation process, and I put it to him at that stage. There is a perception of ethnic minorities breaking into the media. I mean, and KFM would have a role to play in that, and, you know, if KFM were willing to come on board as well, absolutely. Only by all of us working together will we change the way society and the way people are fit into our county.
Absolutely. It's the only way to do anything, isn't it, Aoife? Zoriana Pashik, Chair of Kildare Integration Network, and Aoife Breslin, Chair of the Kildare Interagency Integration Committee. Thank you for joining us. And Kildare County Council will be launching the integration strategy at 11 a.m. this morning.
Thank you for that. Yes, very, very busy. And I understand Minister Roderick O'Gorman is in town to launch that at 11 o'clock this morning. Now, thank you for all the entries that came in. We had our winners. We had them actually within about, I'd say, less than 90 seconds in terms of the texters of WhatsAppers. And we'll announce the winners of those three CDs before we go to air at 11 o'clock. Right, just having a look at a couple of, well, actually, I don't know, can I even catch up on the other messages at this stage? I think I talked about Bill Wepernick early on. But in regards as well to, oh God, I forgot this, 80th birthday greetings. Clem, you know Bill and May in Mansfield Grove in Athy? Well, May is 80 years old today. Bill is her devoted husband of 60 years. He's the best uncle ever in the world. May and Bill are two of the very best people you are ever going to meet in this life. I had a little party for her yesterday. So Clem, please wish May a wonderful birthday from all the Gruffordys, Hickeys, Conways and Days. Thanks again. Kind regards from Mary Grufferty Flood, who Bill and May in Mansfield Grove Athy. Didn't give me his surname, but happy birthday and 80th birthday and 60 years of marriage. What great stuff that is in relation to it. Well, let's move from birthdays now to spiders, because certainly I know our Ciara isn't a great, great fan of spiders, but a warning has been issued in regards to the prevalence of these spiders that are called false widows in Ireland as temperatures begin to drop. The National Poisons Information Centre says false widows do not randomly bite. Well, that's not going to be great consolation, but let's find out more from a spider expert. They're called arachnologists. Miles Nolan, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you?
Right, an arachnologist. You're the first one I've met, I think, Mark. What's your fascination with spiders?
Oh, well, I've been studying them for over 30 years now, so I couldn't tell you at this stage. I spent too much time with them.
I know that recently on WhatsApp I saw an interesting thing in regards to spiders. We'll talk about the false widows in just... Well, actually, let's talk about the false widows first. Now, the National Poisons Information Centre is issuing this warning about the false widow, whose venom is more potent than that of our native spiders as temperatures begin to drop. Give us a profile of this false widow spider and where it has emerged from.
Okay, well, I got the first record of a species in Ireland. That was back in 1997, okay? And it was obviously very well established down in Bray, County Wicklow, where I found it. And since then, I've been kind of tracking it around the country. By the early 2000s, it had made its way to Cork and Limerick and so on. And now it is established, it's, you know, found it very widely across the country, and most especially in built-up areas and bigger towns. Cities, but you'll also find it on the outside of isolated houses. So,
what does it look like, Miles?
It starts out as a very small spiderling. The adults are fairly dark body, usually very kind of blackish looking. They have a fairly distinctive white pattern on their back. Their legs look black. You often see them at night because they're a nocturnal species, but if you see them in daylight, their legs are actually brown and you get kind of a reddish marking.
No, I understand.
They're relatively large. It's hard to describe a spider accurately over the radio because everyone will start thinking everything they see is a spider.
Well, maybe they just leave it alone. No matter what spider you see, might be the answer there. It's the most common urban spider, I understand. It's tolerant to cold temperatures and it lives for a 5-year plan. It makes it competitive against native Irish spiders. Competitive in what way?
Well, I would disagree with some of those statements, okay?
Right.
It has become extremely abundant around Ireland, and like I said, I live in Dublin City. I live in Rathmines, and it's all over Rathmines, around all of these places. I see it everywhere I go. But there are other urban spiders that are also extremely common. And to my mind, to be perfectly honest, they don't necessarily interfere with one another. I think it's easy to say that something like the false widow is impacting other spiders, but it's actually not been proven in any specific way. And there are spiders, for example, that don't build webs, they just wander around or hunt, and they wouldn't really come across false widows, you know. So that's, to my mind, that's a question that's still to be
answered. All right, okay. Originating from Madeira and the Canary Islands, probably came in on ships and boats and fruit and stuff like that.
It's been moving through the Mediterranean. It's established itself in, it occurred in Britain many decades ago at the outskirts and turned up.
And what about at the risk of alarming the whole country? What about the symptoms if you get a bite from it? Pain, redness, swelling of the area?
Well, I mean, if you get a bite, treat it like any other bite. If you've got a wasp sting, it will be painful initially. If it's really painful 2 hours later, there might be a problem.
Are we not talking nausea, vomiting, headache, hot and cold flushes? Oh, my God.
No. The occasional person will get some of them. And there have been one or two extremely strong reactions to venom. But these were individuals who, talking with one of them, they got a massive dose of venom from a large adult female. I know other individuals who got a bite, for example, on the finger by a smaller specimen, and they felt a little bit off colour for a few hours, and they got a little bit of swelling around the bite, but that was it.
All right.
And other people who had practically no reaction at all.
All right, now we know our Kira in particular here is absolutely terrified of spiders. She swings out of the chandeliers if someone even says the word spider in regards to that.
She's having a bad day.
But I saw recently, and I shared this message with others, that it's the mating season and that spiders only want loving under our wardrobes. But on the good side of it, they also eat up vast quantities of the nasty mites that can do damage. Spiders are a great bunch of lads, said the Post. For example, spiders eat pests. They feed on common indoor pests such as clothes moths, silverfish, earwigs, house flies. Who knew, I say? Gnats and midges, roaches, horseflies, mosquitoes and fleas.
Yep.
And there's people swatting. One of our greatest warriors and greatest collaborators. Should we always welcome the spiders then into the house, even if they're making love underneath the wardrobe?
there might be a very occasional one making love under the water. But yes, I think essentially, you know, the vast majority of spiders that are in your house are not doing you, they're not there to do you any harm. The ones that come in that live in general outdoors, including the false widow, are wandering in largely by accident. They don't particularly want to be there. The ones who are established in your house are actually doing a bit of pest control. You want to consider all those other animals pests. So, you know, I wouldn't, you know, I think you're wasting in energy swatting these animals every time you see them. If you want to, if you don't like the fact that the spider's in your house, I understand that, and pop them outdoors, but most of the ones are completely harmless.
I think this came from the British naturalist Chris Packham, whom we often see on our television doing these great nature programmes. He says, look, we only see them for 10 minutes in total in a year. Don't put the spiders out. Let them disappear into the far recess of your cupboards, and they provide a free home sanitation service for you. If you're scared of them, deal with your fear. They are your best mates. So we all need to look at spiders in a different way then.
A little bit, I think. I mean, they obviously have a scare factor, but you do have to consider there are over 400 species of spider in Ireland, and the false widow that has only become well established over the last 20 years, it does have, it can have a quite a nasty bite. But, you know, like I said, there's very large populations in and around Dublin over the last decade,
right.
20 years at least, and there are very, very few bites.
I have one question. One last question for you, Miles Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
This is completely sexist, and I'll get killed for it, but you're the expert here. Why is it that women in particular are so terrified of spiders?
In my experience, actually, it's fairly balanced between the sexes. I've known people who I have a cousin who is goes catatonic at the sight of the spider. he cannot operate. He's not as bad as he used to be, and I've known a few other fellows who have been like that over the years. And I've known, well, there's been a few women who've studied spiders in Ireland over the last few years in universities and such like, and they've been well able for them. So I'm going to rescue you from your sexism and say that fear of spiders is balanced.
Well, thank you very much for that, Miles Nolan, and I'm sure Ciarán Noble is not at all reassured, because the minute she hears the word spider, the word bazooka kind of jumps into her vocabulary.
Can I say one last little thing? I know
of course.
You're probably pressed for
no,
that.
No, go ahead.
I just want to say that one of those press releases that went out, you know, this idea that because it's getting a bit cold, all the spiders are suddenly rushing indoors, that doesn't happen, okay? The false widow lives primarily outdoors on the outsides of houses. When it gets a bit cold, it doesn't really register. It's used to the cold. But when specimens do come indoors, it's accidental wandering around. Just to get that out there.
All right, I'm glad
so
you said
all
that.
All the houses of Ireland are not being targeted by spiders now that there's a touch of chill in the air.
I'm glad you said that, because the sound of locking windows and banging doors and cellar doors being locked and walls being scanned was
and the bazooka's coming
and
out.
And the bazooka's coming out was well underway. Arachnologist, specialist and spider expert Miles Nolan debunking some of the myths. And basically, listen, the message for the spiders is they're not going to bother you, so don't bother them. And according to Chris Packham, they're actually giving us a free sanitation service in our homes. So you can even bring one into bed with you, because if you have fleas, the spider will take care of the fleas. Miles, great talking to you. Thanks very much.
Very welcome.
And good morning to you, Miles Nolan on that.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, some reaction, by the way, to some of our items regarding the female genital mutilation. A listener asks, are mothers of the babies and girls aware when this practice is taking place? Yes, they are, is the answer. It is the mothers and fathers, sometimes together, sometimes separately, who actually bring their daughters, whether they be babies or teenagers, to have this practice inflicted upon them. And whatever rationale, and I can't think of any, for this practice culturally in other countries in Africa, it cannot be absolutely accepted or acknowledged or facilitated in any way in this country. It is not done legally. It's done in back streets. And we know that in the past, the damage that backstreet abortions did, and women lost their lives and were left in the most distressing circumstances, even if they survived. So now we have a scenario in this country where over 6,000 women in Ireland have been subjected to having their clitoris cut in the most gruesome, unhygienic, unmedical, savage terms as such, in back rooms, in back streets, not just in Dublin. This is not a Dublin phenomenon. All around this country. And we have 16 other young girls who could be at risk of it as well. There needs to be an education, a widespread education campaign, that this is not tolerated. And if people have any information or suspicions about it, they need to bring it to the attention of authorities. €10,000 the fine, 14 years in jail, the maximum sentence. But I'm only aware of one case in my memory that I've seen come to the courts, which came in the last year or so, about the appalling damage done to a young baby who died when this practice was being carried out. I cannot articulate in words my abhorrence of that practice. Right, elsewhere on another drinking at games, Paul has been in touch to say in regards to that. I was at a rugby game in Twickenham between Ireland and England a few years ago. It was my only away experience of an away match. It was completely ruined by a continuous procession of England supporters with their drinks. This started well before starting time, and I thought, this will stop when the game begins. No, I was wrong, says Paul. It continued for the whole game. The whole experience was ruined by this, and to make matters worse, Ireland were hammered, and their nearest attempt at scoring was a drop goal attempt by Rob Kearney, which hit the post. At the crucial moment, when the ball hit the post, a person stepped in front of me with his drink. I wrote to the English Rugby Union about my disappointment. I'm sure that got places, Paul, anyway. Yeah, can you imagine this jumping up and down for a jar? Drive me nuts if I was watching a game. Go and watch the match. You can have the pints if you feel that way disposed afterwards. Anyway, let's speak to Liz Cullen. Good morning, Liz. How are you doing this morning? And you're here because you want to know, has any listener got a copy of a school book? What's the school book?
That's exactly it, Clem. I'm looking for a copy of An Outline of Irish Geography. And I remember using it in primary school in the 60s. And it detailed all the towns in Ireland and all the industries in each town, like shoemaking and sugar factories. And we had to remember all these activities. And I want to compare what's happening now in towns in Ireland to that list in that book. Because I think we're going to have to reduce our carbon footprint and meet our needs more locally. And it's really important that we have these, we make sugar in Ireland. So anyway, I just want to compare the industries in my school days and the industries now in Irish towns.
Well, I can tell you, Liz, there'll be a very big difference because there's no sugar made here anymore. I think I recall that book. In the sense of the that if for every town, certainly most of the towns in every county, you had to go and learn a bloody list of everything that was made in that town.
That's right.
And you're hoping that somebody might have a copy of that, just to give you a loan of it, is it?
A loan would be, just for one night, I just photocopied the pages. I would just love a copy of An Outline of Irish Geography in primary school book.
All right. Well, all we can say, Liz, is we have it out there. What's the name of it again?
An Outline of Irish Geography. I think it had a yellow cover.
Right. I can't quite remember what colour it had, but I seem to remember in primary school having something like that. And again, Tuam. You learned about Tuam. It made sugar. You learned about Newbridge. It made turf. You learned about Carlow. They had sugar and other things. Yes. And you had to learn the names of all the rivers in the country.
That's
and
right.
Where the rivers rose and where the rivers met the sea. Oh, Lord, it brings sort of horrors back to me in regards to many sense. If anybody has a copy of that book, name again, Liz, one more time.
An Outline of Irish Geography.
an outline of Irish geography, please get in touch with us here at the station, 045-898-999, and we'll put you in touch with Liz, and she only wants a loan of it to check it out. Right, Liz?
Thanks, Clem, very much. I appreciate that.
Not at all. Thank you indeed for joining us. Now, it's quite a while since we did a bit of poetry, and I got a poem, I think, recently from a listener who's well known to this programme. She's been on with us often because her daughter Ava requires round-the-clock care 24 hours a day, and her two boys are on the autistic spectrum. She's one of our great, great heroes. As Irish mothers are generally anyway, including my own. Samantha Kenny, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you, Clem?
I'm very well. Samantha Kenny, as if you haven't enough on your plate 24 hours a day, you have written a poem that will resonate with every mother. It's called A Mother's Sleep. And the reason I love it is it starts with what happens to mothers when they're taking care of babies and then younger people. And then eventually teenagers, as everyone grows, the worry of where are they? Why aren't they home? And things like that govern a mother's life. It's a mother's sleep. Off you go.
A mother's sleep is precious, so people always stay. The advice begins immediately on how to make it stay. From day one, they tell you, now while your baby's small, make sure you nap while they nap, or you won't sleep at all. From baby until preschool, there seems to be so much change. From 3 a.m, must tell you, to the monster's back again. The endless up and down, in and out, I said good night to the extra bump in the bed who refuses to turn out the light. The extra body parts akimbo in the bed to the starfish forcing you to sleep upon the edge. They grow, it changes. The 3 a.m. wakings, they become so few. Or rather, you've acclimatized to a whole another view of lightly sleeping and waking to hear a key inside the door and knowing once again your family are all home and safe just like before. Then before you know, they are gone and your sleep becomes your own. Or rather, it becomes a place to worry about all the things that could go wrong. Are they safe? Did you teach them well? Will they be good people? Only time will tell. Once you are a mother, sleep is precious, so they say. They just never warn you how much love gets in the way.
I think that's lovely. It's wonderful. Once you are a mother, sleep is precious, so they say. They just never warn you how much love gets in the way. And that those two lines really underpin the whole theme of the poem. That from when they're babies to then youngsters, Mommy, I have to tell you something at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the monsters are back again. Turn out the light. Mommy, I want to get into your bed. And then to when they're teenagers, where are they? What are they up to? Why aren't they home? And then when they're gone altogether. A mother's sleep is precious. So people always say, the advice begins immediately on how to make it stay. Are the opening lines? Once you are a mother, sleep is precious, so they say. They just never warn you how much love gets in the way. The final two lines. Lovely poem, Samantha. Are you taken to writing poetry occasionally, obviously?
I've kind of always written poetry, but sometimes the urge just comes. I actually need to go out and buy a notebook today because I have a few other things rattling around in my head. I just enjoy doing it. It's a nice way to let stuff out.